I have to apologize that I haven't actually made beautiful transparencies for this lecture. I'm trying to get some transparencies of slides, rather, for the next time. But this time I wanted to begin by just using the blackboard and talking sort of generally, rather than plunging right into the technical stuff in the chapter, as a way of just motivating what I want to talk about and getting some ideas out. And then I'll actually just use the pages of the chapter and pick out some things that I want to talk about here. Okay, so the story really begins, these issues of quantum information, with the debate between Einstein and Bohr on the foundations of quantum mechanics. I want to speak a little bit about Einstein, Einstein's argument for the incompleteness of quantum mechanics, which introduced entangled states, brought entangled states to the attention of people, the significance of entangled states, and then talk about Bell's counterargument, and it was really John Bell, who one might think of as sort of the father of quantum information in one sense, and in many fathers, but in the sense that he showed that, in a sense, suggested that you might be able to do something with entanglement. And then I want to just talk a little bit about why this connects up with the notions of information. And then that'll be sort of the first part of today's talk. And we'll just see how it goes, and I'll take a look at these notes. These are plugged in here. Okay, so I want to begin with a quote from Einstein. And this comes from some correspondence between Einstein and Max Born. Born, there's a whole book Born edited on the Einstein-Born correspondence. And if you take a look at it, it's clear that Einstein felt frustrated with Max Born. He felt he didn't really understand what he was on about. And many of the letters, Born does seem just not to get what Einstein's point was. In one letter that Einstein wrote, he quotes back Max Born's comments with his own comments, like Born blush, because he just thinks that what he said is stupid. But then he goes on to make this statement, which is often quoted. He says, "I just want to explain what I mean when I say that we should try to hold on to physical reality. We all of us have some idea of what the basic axioms in physics will turn out to be. The quantum or the particle will surely not be amongst them. The field in Faraday's and Maxwell's sense could possibly be, but it's not certain. And here's the relevant bit for the rest. But whatever we regard as existing, real, in parentheses, should somehow be localized in time and space. That is, the real in part of space A should, in theory, somehow exist," this is quote-unquote, "independently of what is thought of as real in space B. When a system in physics extends over the parts of space A and B, then that which exists in B should somehow exist independently of that which exists in A. That which really exists in B should therefore not depend on what kind of measurement is carried out in part of space A. It should also be independent of whether or not any measurement at all is carried out in space A. If one adheres to this program, one can hardly consider the quantum theoretical description as a complete representation of the physically real. If one tries to do so in spite of this, one has to assume that the physical real in B suffers a sudden change as a result of a measurement in A. My instinct for physics bristles at this. However, if one abandons the assumption that what exists in different parts of space has its own independent real existence, then I simply cannot see what it is that physics is meant to describe. For what is thought to be a system is, after all, just a convention. And I cannot see how one could divide the world objectively in such a way that one could make statements about parts of it." Now, in other places, he refers to, he makes similar comments. And when he talks about the assumption that what exists in different parts of space has its own independent real existence, he uses the phrase, its own independent being thus. And he puts it in quotes. So things, the world is understood as, you could summarize the point of view here as involving two principles. The first principle is the principle of separability, which is that the world separates out into things which have their own being thuses. You know, this thing is this way, and that thing is that way, and they have their being thuses separately. Now, we'll see in a minute that you could think of this being thus as some sort of set of properties or something like that, I mean, standard view. But it could also just be, as far as the arguments that I'm going to consider in a minute are concerned, just a kind of stochastic being thus. That, you know, there's something here which sort of produces its own probabilities, and there's something else here which produces its own probabilities. And so those are sort of stochastic being thuses. And as far as the arguments, the argument for completeness is concerned, all you have to assume is that this being thus could be a stochastic notion. And the other principle is what you might call a locality principle. Separability and locality. And the locality principle is that you can't change the being thus over there, the probabilities over there, by making measurements over here. Actually, more generally, by doing anything over here, but he specifically refers to making measurements over here. What did he say? That which exists, blah, blah, blah. It, the being thus, or the independent real existence, should not depend on what kind of measurement is carried out in some other part of space. So that's this locality claim. So these are two principles which seem to underlie Einstein's notion of realism. I'm introducing this because I want to make clear precisely in what sense quantum mechanics involves problems with this notion. I mean, I actually, for many years, when I sort of started out with this stuff, thought that Einstein was right and Bohr was wrong. But, you know, for a long time now, it seems to me that whether or not one wants to say that Bohr literally was correct, and it's not maybe clear what Bohr had in mind, but in the debate between Einstein and Bohr, it seems that the sort of thing that Bohr was going for, at least this is my point of view, is right and Einstein was wrong in insisting on these notions as fundamental. So there are these two notions. Now, let me just read one other quote, because it's often taken to be the case that when Einstein's real prejudice, so to speak, was for determinism. And in this correspondence between Einstein and Born, there are a few letters by Powell who intervened at one point and tried to explain Einstein's position to Max Born. So I'm just going to read a quote from this letter from Pauli to Born. It's dated 1954. He says, "Now, from my conversation with Einstein, I've seen that he takes exception to the assumption, essential to quantum mechanics, that the state of a system is defined only by specification of an experimental arrangement. Einstein wants to know nothing of this. If one were able to measure with sufficient accuracy, this would, of course, be as true for small macroscopic spheres as for electrons. It is, of course, demonstrable by specifying thought experiments, and I presume that you've mentioned and discussed some of these in your correspondence with Einstein. But Einstein has the philosophical prejudice that, for macroscopic bodies, a state termed real, quote-unquote, can be defined objectively, quote-unquote, under any circumstances." I mean, this would be what Einstein refers to as the being thus. That is, without specification of the experimental arrangement used to examine the system of the macrobodies or to which the system is being subjected. It seems to me that the discussion with Einstein can be reduced to this hypothesis of his, which I've called the idea or the ideal of the detached observer. But to me and other representatives of quantum mechanics, it seems that there's sufficient experimental and theoretical evidence against the practicability of this ideal. Then he goes on to say, so he says what Einstein is, does not accept is a principle which he and the other, Bohr all accept, and Heisenberg, that is something, of course, that the rejection of the principle of the detached observer. You're going to say, also, Einstein gave you your manuscript to read. He was not at all annoyed with you, but only said you were a person who will not listen. This agrees with the impression I formed myself, insofar as I was unable to recognize Einstein whenever you talked about him in either your letter or your manuscript. It seemed to me as if you had erected some dummy Einstein for yourself, which you then knocked down with great pomp. In particular, Einstein does not, this is the point I want to make, does not consider the concept of determinism to be as fundamental as it's frequently held to be, as he told me emphatically many times. And he denied energetically that he'd ever put up a postulate such as, your letter, paragraph 3, quote, the sequence of such conditions must also be objective and real, that is, automatic, machine-like, deterministic. He's quoting back Born. In the same way, he disputes that he uses a criterion for the admissibility of the theory of the question, is it rigorously deterministic? Einstein's point of departure is realistic rather than deterministic, which means that his philosophical prejudice is a different one. Okay, so and the philosophical prejudice there is these two principles, which does not have anything to do with determinism. Okay, now let's see if we can just formulate this a little more precisely. If you're thinking about separating systems and making measurements on them, then we could talk about a system over here and a system over here. I'm always hard on chalk, so it all seems to break. Let's talk about making measurements, say A prime, and so on over here, and B prime, and so on over here. Then the principle of separability could be formulated this way, that there's some underlying being thus, which I'm going to give a little tag lambda to. And if I'm going to be measuring, say, A on this side and B on the other side, I'll put the A and the B on top there and say the probability of A. The probability of getting an outcome A for B. So I'll use capital A's and B's and so on for the measurements, and little a's and b's for the values, the outcomes. A might have two possible values, plus and minus one, and the little a denotes that, a variable for plus and minus one. So this is just going to be the probability a, and similarly the probability of a b, b given a is equal to, that is to say, the outcome of a, if you're measuring a on the left and b on the right, the outcome, if you really have the being thus, the probability of the outcome of getting A for A, given that you measure B, should be independent of B, of the outcome B. And it should also be independent of whether or not you measure B or B prime and so on. And that could be formulated this way. The probability of A, B, given lambda of getting A, is just equal to the probability of getting A. That is, if you're measuring A on the left and B on the right, then the probability of getting a particular outcome for A is independent of what you measure for B. Similarly, for B prime, B double prime, and so on. And I could also write A, B, lambda, B equals B and some of a so on. From the frame prime, double prime. So these are the two principles of Einstein formulated as probabilistic principles. And it turns out that you can prove that these two principles, separability and locality, hold if and only if lambda is a common cause of the probabilities. Now, what I mean by a common cause is this. If you have correlations between the left and the right, so which is to be expressed this way. Suppose I, just picking A and B, I should mention that the, I'll say that in a minute. To say that there are correlations is to say that the joint probability is not equal to the product of the probability. Obviously the primes and so on, any combination. So this says that I've got correlations. If the correlations are the result of a common cause, lambda, then this holds. Probability of A and B given lambda is equal to the probability of A given lambda times the probability of B given lambda, where the probability of A, or A and B, or B and so on, is understood as the probability of A given lambda times some probability distribution of lambda in lambda. So let me just say what's going on here. These are the probabilities that one actually measures. This is the joint probability of getting an outcome A on the left and B on the right. If they're correlations, then the joint probability is not equal to the product. If these correlations are common cause of the correlations, more precisely. If these correlations between your measurements on the left and the right are due to a common cause, some kind of condition which will mean that the left system and the right system, the system A prime and so on, so B prime and B double prime system, if the probabilities here, given the common cause, are independent of this one, of this system over here, then you've said it got down to sort of the rock bottom. I mean, it might be the case that this system ultimately is still a stochastic system, and that you don't have determinism. But what you would like, if these systems are really separate from the sense of Einstein and have their own being thus, is that there's some condition lambda, maybe a condition in the path of the two systems, which is responsible for the correlations. So for example, I mean, if I just had classical correlations of the following sort, and if I took a deck of cards, say, and cut them in half, and sent one half this way and one half that way, there'd be a correlation in suit and color and so on. But the correlation would be due to a common cause, which is what I did in the past to the two cards. And given the common cause, well, the probabilities would be 1 or 0 for any particular, let's say, color, because you would know, because the different common causes would be, I mean, the different lambdas, lambda would range over all possible cards. But the situation might be stochastic, so that once I specified the common cause, there were some statistics over here and some statistics over here, which maybe depended on local conditions, but had nothing to do with what was going on here. And then I would have, so to speak, gotten down to sort of like the rock bottom specification of the two systems in terms of their unique masses. And so, so once you get down to the common cause, then the two systems are independent. So these are the surface probabilities, if you like. And these, if you want to talk in terms of hidden variables, thinking in terms of the being thus as the hidden variables which underlie the stochastics that you actually see, and once you've got down to that actual specification of the being thus of the system, then the joint probabilities should just be a product of two probabilities. And this is just the definition of what I mean by the surface probability, or the one that's actually measured in terms of the hidden lambda or common cause, or hidden lambda or common cause, or being thus probabilities. So in the case of my card example, the rho lambda would just be choosing a card from a pack randomly, let's say. So these would just be the same probabilities for the different cards. And I would just have a sum because I have a finite number of lambdas, the number of cards in the deck. Each card has the same probability. And so I would sum up over those probabilities to get PA and to get PB and to get PAN. And Einstein tried by several different arguments to show that quantum mechanics was incomplete. And the idea was to use entangled quantum states to mount an argument of the following sort. So suppose you have two systems, your left system and your right system, and they're prepared in an entangled state. Let me write that down. The state is this. Let me make clear that it's two systems. So I'll write the state this way. Let's say 0, 1, minus 1, 0. So I prepare the system in this entangled state, and this 0, 1 might be up in the z direction, 0 might be up in the z direction, 1 down in the z direction. This state, because of its symmetry properties, takes the same form if you consider spinning the x direction or y direction or any other direction. So Einstein argued that, look, if you measure spin in the z direction on this system, you're going to get 0 or 1. If you get 0 or 1, compared to quantum mechanics, the state either goes to this or it goes to this. And so you can predict with certainty the outcome of a measurement over here. If you get 0 on the left, it's going to be 1 on the right. That is, if you get spin up on the left, it's going to be spin down on the right, and conversely. And the argument for incompleteness just follows immediately. You don't have to consider other spin measurements, but the simple form of the argument would just be that if you make a measurement here, and on the basis of the measurement, you can predict with certainty the outcome here, which was the criterion for an elemental reality over there, and being thus over there, in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, then which you can in this case, because the state is now this, so the state is, you can predict the outcome of a measurement over there. There must be an element of reality over there, in the sense of this being thus. But quantum mechanics is incomplete because the state, before you made the measurement, is this state, which only has a probability of half for a detection of that being thus, that particular being thus. And so the quantum state doesn't express the actual being thus, which you know must be there. And there are two principles involved here. One, principle that if you predict the certainty of the outcome of a measurement, then there's a being thus there. And the other principle being the locality principle, that if you, it can't be the case if I'm making a measurement here, you can change anything over there. But if you can predict the certainty, then the claim is now you know what the being thus is, but that contradicts that state, so quantum mechanics is complete. You could make a similar argument by just considering making a measurement in another direction, leave the state in the same form, you could make the same prediction, and so you could say that there are two being thuses, one associated with X spin and one associated with Z spin, and then say that there's a quantum state which describes the being thus for both X, an actual a being thus which makes both the position and makes both X spin and Z spin precise. So this was the Heisak-Podolsky-Rosen argument for the incompleteness of quantum mechanics, the incompleteness of the state description. Okay, I want to move on quickly to Bell's argument, which is really crucial, and then consider, make some comments about Bell's paper against measurement, and then hook this up with information as a way of motivating taking a look at both classical and quantum information. So that was Einstein's argument for the incompleteness of quantum mechanics based on these two principles which characterize his notion of realism. Not the only notion of realism, but a particularly relevant notion of realism. And the particular formulation of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument involved this particular criterion for there being a being thus of this criterion of if you can make a measurement of here without disturbing the system of there, predict this with certainty, then there must be an element of reality. So that's just a way, it's just an additional, let's say, criterion for identifying reality. Which is proposed in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper and not in quotation. Okay, so about 30 years later, because the EPR argument first was 1935 and Bell came up with this argument in 1965 or so, Bell considered measurements on the two systems not in the same direction. So you measure spin in the x direction here and spin in the z direction here or some other direction, and then show that you get correlations which are inconsistent with Einstein's notions of separability and locality. So let me just show that in a particular way because this raises a number of interesting issues. I want to derive Bell's inequality in a particular way. Okay, so here's a derivation of Bell's inequality. Because I want to show really what goes into it. Consider the expression, which I'm just going to call K and define in the following way. I build it up this way. Plus 1 minus alpha. It's going to be built up of alpha prime, beta, and beta prime, all of which are between 1 and 0. So I'm going to write down this expression. This is alpha prime plus 1 minus alpha prime. Alpha prime plus 1 minus alpha prime. Beta prime, beta, 1 minus beta, 1 minus beta prime. Okay, so now this expression is a convex combination of convex combinations. That is, this is alpha is between zero, every term, all the alphas and betas are between zero and one. So this is some number between zero and one plus one minus alpha something else. So this whole k is between this number and this number because it's a convex combination of these two numbers. But this number itself is a convex combination of these two numbers. And this number here is a convex combination of these two numbers. So this thing is between 1 minus beta and 1 minus beta prime. But because beta and beta prime are between 0 and 1, this is between 0 and 1. And beta is similar to beta and beta prime, so this thing is between 0 and 1. So the whole thing has to be zero. So just by looking at it, this lies between zero and one. Okay, that's just a piece of mathematics. Because the complex combination of convex combinations of terms which are between zero and one, the whole thing has to be between zero and one. Now, if you multiply that expression out, so so far I haven't assumed anything. There's no physics, obviously, but if you multiply the whole thing out, then you get alpha plus, alpha plus beta plus alpha prime beta prime times alpha prime beta minus alpha beta prime minus alpha prime beta prime is less than greater than equal to zero. That's just expanding that expression. Okay? So we proved that this is between zero and one. Now I'm going to let's take this expression will also hold if I take this as alpha.
I guess we have alpha beta, alpha plus beta plus alpha beta, because otherwise, we have two terms in alpha prime beta prime, which is not right.
Oh, this is supposed to be alpha. Sorry, this is not right. You're right. Alpha beta alpha prime beta prime. This is the way it's alpha beta alpha prime beta and alpha beta
prime.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
So okay. I cannot check because I didn't see the alpha formula.
Sorry, the alpha formula.
So maybe we just use the two alpha black ones.
Maybe what's that?
If you just use the two alpha black ones.
Oh, these black ones? Yeah. Oh, let's look at them. Oh, sorry, okay. I'll write down that. So let's leave that there. And I'll move here. And write down this expression, K, which is equal to alpha plus beta plus alpha prime beta prime minus alpha beta minus alpha prime beta minus alpha beta prime is between 1 and 0.
And there's no term alpha alpha prime?
No, alpha alpha prime? No. They cancel out. Yeah. Okay, so there's this. Now, if I define the probability given my common cause of getting A plus, let's say, let's suppose that. Suppose that I'm talking, let me make it clear. Talking about measurements on two systems where I have correlations, and I'm going to be measuring A and A prime and B prime on this system, and A will have two possible values, A plus and A minus. A prime will have two possible values, A prime plus, simply for B. So these are the values of the observable A, these are the values of the observable B. These might be plus minus one, but I want to make a distinction between the A values and the B values. So now, suppose they're correlations when you make the measurement. And suppose the correlations, that is to say, suppose that A and B not equal to B of A, B of B, etc. That is correlations. They exist correlations when you make a measure. So separate all that is a piece of mathematics, and now I'm saying, okay, now suppose you've got two systems, and you're measuring A and A prime on the one, and B prime on the other, and you find correlations. Suppose the correlations are the result of a common cause. Lambda. Okay? Which means that once you're given lambda, the probability of lambda in lambda is equal to A times the probability of B. That means once you're given lambda, then the two sides are independent. Now, define the probability of A plus, that is getting the outcome plus, as alpha, etc. By which I mean beta is the probability of getting B plus, and B prime, beta prime is the probability of getting B prime plus, and so on. Then I can write down, well, I can rearrange this, I guess. Then I can write down the expression as an expression for probabilities, which is P of A plus B plus P of A prime and B prime minus P of A and B minus P of A prime and B minus P of A and B prime is less than or equal to 1, and all these are flat. Okay. Now, similarly, if I define probability of getting a minus given lambda as equal to alpha, etc., I mean for all the others, then I can derive this inequality. 0 less than, I mean, the same thing, with plus, with minus, so the lambda probably. So it's exactly the same expression, everywhere I've got an A, I've got a plus number 1. So now, so add them, adding the two inequalities, I get the following. 0 is less than, if I add PA plus and PA minus, I get 1, and if I add PB plus and PB minus, I get 2. And then if I add, if put this next step, we get PA minus and B minus prime, I get, okay, now let me just think for a second, I get, I actually, I'm sorry, I skipped a step, which didn't notice, but let me just say this. I get A prime is equal to B prime, because this is probably A plus and B plus the probability of A, of getting A minus and B minus, which is the sum of these two probabilities, and that's just the probability of getting A prime, of the probability that these two are equal. Probability of these two are equal is the probability that they're both plus, or that they're both minus, right? This probability here, let me write this on this map book, probability of A prime is equal to B prime is equal to the probability of A prime getting A prime plus B prime plus the probability of A prime minus and B prime minus. Because this is the probability of plus or minus, and these events are exclusive, so this probability is just the sum of these two probabilities. So I can write this as a minus A equal B minus A prime B minus A equal B prime, right, is less than or equal to 2 now. Now there's a step that I left out, I made a jump, and it's a very important step. Maybe I'll just leave that to the end, so I'll just continue this calculation. Now all I do is subtract 2 to clean it up, and flip the order because I multiply by minus 1, and what I get is PA equal B plus P A prime equals B plus PA equals B prime minus PA prime equals B prime is less than or equal to 2. And let me go on over here. Almost done. And so I get 0. I rewrite this as a over b plus the probability of a prime b plus the probability of a over b prime plus the probability of a prime not equal to b prime is less than or equal to 3, because the probability of a prime not equal to b prime is equal to 1 minus the probability of a equal to b. A prime equal to b. Okay, so for this expression here, I put 1 minus probability that they're not equal. And then I get a 1 on this side, a minus 1 on this side, and I put it on that side. Okay? And so I don't need that. So this is the relevant quantity level. I'm just sort of forgetting about that. Okay, so this is Bell's inequality in a, let's say, revised Clauser on Shimoni Holt form. I mean, there are various forms of Bell's inequality, but this particular form is very closely related to a form derived by Clauser, Horn, Abner, Shimoni, and John Holt. And that inequality is just, let me put it here, is just the same as this essentially, but it is the expectation value of, written in this way, plus the expectation value of A prime B, plus the expectation of A B prime, minus the expectation value of A prime B prime, is less than or equal to 2. Okay, this is the Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, Holt inequality. The Clauser, Horn, and Shimoni and Holt derive this inequality, where this E is expectation. So the expectation value of the product of AB plus the expectation value of the product of A prime B, AB prime minus A prime B prime is less than or equal to 2. I have expressed the underwriting inequality in the form of probabilities. Because I want to connect it up with something else, and I've written it in this form. I had a minus A prime equal B prime, and I had 2 here. I just made a minor change there. Okay, that's the Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, Holt inequality. Put a big square box on this thing. And we've now actually derived this. Now, I skipped a step, which is actually crucial, and the crucial step. I mean, it's the whole point that connects up with what I did before. I mean, it's the main point of the proof. Just to run back, so that you're not lost. What did I do? I wrote down just a mathematical expression, which was between 0 and 1. And then I associated the terms in that mathematical expression with probabilities, with these common cause probabilities. And I did it for the plus probabilities and the minus probabilities, and then I derived an inequality for the outcomes of the measurements of these two systems. Well, there isn't any physics in there at all, there isn't any assumption in there at all. It looks like just pure mathematics. So it should apply to any theory. But actually, there is an assumption, and I skipped that step, maybe because I just went too fast. And that's the crucial assumption that Einstein makes. And so I want to show you where it is. I said before that Einstein's realist assumptions could be encapsulated in these two conditions of separability and locality. And I also said that I didn't show you that the assumption of separability and locality formulated in terms of those lambda probabilities turns out to be equivalent in a precise mathematical sense. It's a little tedious just to show, but to the principle that all correlations can be reduced to a common cause. That is to say that there's some being thus lambda, and once you give me the being thus, then the left system and the right system are independent. So that assumption comes in here. Now, and it's the only assumption that comes in here. And where does that come in here? Well, I've got product terms here. And I said define, take alpha prime as the lambda probability of getting A plus, or the lambda probability of getting A minus. But then I should get here a term B lambda A prime plus times B lambda B prime plus, right? If I associate alpha prime with this probability and beta prime with this probability. But what I wrote down here was, on a blackboard now, which hasn't been queried enough, it's not good. So all these terms are products, right? But I actually missed two steps. I mean, I ended up with this inequality. First of all, it doesn't have any lambdas in it. And secondly, it's a joint probability, not a product. So the first, let me go here, where the assumption of realism comes into the argument, where something purely mathematical comes into the argument, is precisely the step which enables me to write P lambda, in this particular case, A prime plus and B prime plus, is equal to P lambda A plus times P prime plus, etc. So this is Einstein's assumption. Einstein's realist assumption, which is separability plus locality. Because if you assume separability and locality, then it's equivalent to assuming that there is a lambda such that the joint probabilities just become a product. Because I didn't show that precisely, and I could, but it's straightforward. I mean, there was a separability condition in terms of probabilities and a locality condition in terms of probabilities. If you assume both those conditions, then you get this. And if you assume this, you can derive those conditions. Okay, so that's the piece that I left out, that these products become joints. Now, these joints are still lambda problems. And over here, I don't have any lambda. So I left out another step, which was simply that I really derive this inequality for the lambdas. Now, how do I get rid of the lambdas? Well, I just integrate over all lambda. And if I integrate and say average over all lambda, or if I average all over lambda, then that amounts to just dropping the lambdas. And averaging will not change the inequality, because I'm really multiplying all of these numbers by some probability, the probabilities which sum to one. So it's a really, again, this, in effect, I'm taking a complex combination of terms between 0 and 1, and it's going to be between 0 and 1. So if I integrate up over lambda, it's not going to change the inequality. So there were two steps which I missed. First of all, the crucial step, which is where the non-trivial assumption comes in, and that is precisely in taking the joint lambda probabilities as products, or really going from the product to the joint lambda probability, then integrating up over the lambda probabilities so that I get these so-called surface probabilities, the ones that you actually measure. So it follows then that the probabilities that you actually measure have to satisfy this inequality, and then I added up the two inequalities and I came to this inequality. Now, it So that's the clouds of Horn Shimoni Hotep quality. And the remarkable thing, and this was Bell's point, put in a different way, that this inequality this is sort of like the classical bound. One can show that the bound is different for quantum systems. And this is 1 plus 2 root 2. This is a quantum bound. And 1 plus 2 root 2 is bigger than 3. So roughly 3.8. And so you could violate this inequality for quantum states. And that's effectively what Bell pointed out. So if you violate that inequality for quantum states, I mean, it turns out that this is incorrect. And so if this is incorrect, I mean, this doesn't hold for the actual measurements we make on actual physical systems. It must mean that one of the assumptions that went into the derivation of that inequality doesn't hold. And the only two assumptions that went into it were this separability and locality. So, you know, this has to be given up. The physical world is telling us that that's for those assumptions. I derived the inequality this particular way because I wanted to consider another inequality where you get a 4 here. And this is the inequality that this is the bound for, let's say, non-quantum non-local theories that satisfy Einstein's locality principle. That is, that you can't, by making a measurement here, change the probabilities over there. So let me just talk about this for a bit, and then consider what this all means, and also just raise the question about these different sorts of theories. I mean, you have classical theories, you have quantum theories, which violate this classical bound, but you could also, in principle, have other theories which are non-signaling theories. That is to say, you can't signal from A to B by fiddling around and making measurements on A. And I mean, I'll only use this in order to sort of make some further general comments about Einstein and Bell and the whole issue, and connect the whole thing up with information. Yeah.
What do you mean by non-local then? It's not a signaling. What do you mean by non-local in this line?
Well, I mean that the they. I'm talking when I say bound for inequality. I mean they. Okay, this is sort of redundant. I wrote bound for non-quantum, non-local theories. I mean let me leave that out. So I just said they're non-local. They satisfy the locality principle. I mean they have some states in there that are like entangled states, but they don't violate Einstein's locality principle, just as quantum entanglement does. But let me leave that out. That was a misleading way of putting it. This is the bound for theories that are not quantum, because that's a quantum bound, but theories that satisfy Einstein's locality principle.
So isn't that just contradictory with your first one? I don't understand how that makes sense.
What's contradictory about this? They satisfy Einstein's locality principle, but they don't satisfy the separability principle.
Oh.
Okay. So let me go directly to what such a theory would be. These theories, I'm just talking about this. These theories were proposed by Samuel Pescu and Rawlish, actually I think by some people before him. And they refer to it as Pescu, Rawlish, non-local boxes. And in terms of the notation that I had before, we can simply express what's going on here in the following way. I mean, suppose that you have your system here, like this, the thing that's a box on the screen, it's brought like this, and again, you're measuring A or A prime here and B prime here. And suppose it is the case that the probabilities are as follows, that the probability of A equal B is equal to 1, the probability of A equal B prime is equal to 1, the probability of A prime equal B is 1, that the probability of A prime not equal to B prime is also equal to 1. That characterizes these non-local boxes. The Baskin-Rorlich explicitly wanted to consider whether you could have stronger, I put non-locality there because I was thinking of, the term locality is used in different senses. But here I'm using it in Einstein's sense, which is simply the sense that I can't make a measurement here, it changes probabilities of the thing. In the case of quantum mechanics, you have entangled states, and you can't do something here and change the probabilities of measurement outcomes over there. If you could, you'd be able to signal. But one refers to entanglement, entangled states as non-local in another sense. And so Popescu and Rorlich were wanted to consider class of theories which are more quantum, I mean less classical, even than quantum mechanics, but which had a no-signaling principle, where you could not use the quote-unquote non-local correlations. Now it's a misleading term because of what I said before. You can't use the, let's say, the entanglement correlations to send signals. And so they defined a type of correlation as follows. And clearly with this correlation, which is violated by quantum mechanics, this inequality is saturated at 4, because this is 1, this is 1, this is 1, this is 1, that's 4. So this class of theories that they considered is a class of theories which violates the quantum bound, the so-called Cyrilson bound. Because it was first proved by Cyrilson. For a proof, you can actually go to his website, just Google Cyrilson. What Cyrilson showed, over and above what Bell showed, was that this is the maximum bound for quantum systems. And one can consider, as I'm saying now, a class of theories which violates that bound, but which is an interesting class of theories because it doesn't allow you to, loosely speaking, violate relativity as a relativity principle. Loosely speaking, doesn't allow you to violate the no signaling principle. So what's the where do we want to go from there? Let's go back to Einstein now. I'll leave that there. Okay, so in terms of Einstein, I characterized Einstein's realism in terms of two principles, separability and locality, and I said that's equivalent to a common cause principle, which is that when you've got correlations, say the joint probabilities are non-equal to the products, there's going to be some being thus associated with the systems, such that if you identify the being thus, then you actually have independence with respect to these probabilities. So these two principles are equivalent to this assumption. Now we've seen that this assumption, leads to the bounding equality, that is P A N B plus S N equal to 3, which is violated by violated in nature, I would say violated by quantum mechanics. So something has to go here. Now, the locality principle, as Einstein formulates, is just the principle that you can't change the beingness over there, which we're now thinking of as a stochastic beingness, by making measurements over here. And that one puts now in most of the literature of this as a no signaling principle. And one could take this as, in a way, telling you what you mean by separated systems. I mean, you could understand, resonate to what Einstein was trying to say in this quote that I started off with, where he said, look, the way I understand the world is it has to be sort of split up into separated systems, and they've got their own being thuses, and so on and so forth. You could understand this principle as in effect being constitutive of what you mean by part of what you mean by a separated system. You would say that if I could simply make measurements here and change the stochastic being thus over there, change the probabilities over there instantaneously, purely in virtue of making this measurement, then I wouldn't call that the two systems separate. I would say that they were the same system. So this might be taken as part of what you mean by separated systems. But this other principle about systems having their own being thus, in the sense that you really have something which will make the joint probabilities, and that if you conditionalize on that, yeah, the joint probabilities just become equal to the product of the probabilities, is really a rather special assumption which characterizes quantum systems. Now I want to show that you could really, I mean, this is a bit of a stretch, but I hope it's sort of going to become clear in terms of partly motivate the later discussion. It seems to me that what underlies this principle is an assumption that you can clone the being thuses, that you can copy being thuses. Because think of it in the following way. I mean, this is going to make a connection with information theory.
Last question. Yeah. I get those three upper bounds there, like in the things. So, which one is the value you get when you perform an experiment? So.
Well, you always conform to this bound. Yeah. You violate this bound, then all the experiments we actually do in quantum mechanics are consistent with this bound. Mm-hmm. And as far as we know, there are no systems which violate this bound. So this class of theories is just a broader class of theories, which you could conceive. And I'm mentioning it here because it's interesting. I mean, I said that my underlying motivation was to take a look at these results in quantum information to shed light on the interpretive problem. So it's interesting to consider why nature chooses quantum theory. I mean, you know, why quantum rather than classical? And hence, more interestingly, or as interestingly, why quantum and not this? Because you might have thought that if you violate this bound over here, then you'd be able to signal. But that's not the case. You could have no signaling theories, which satisfy at least part of Einstein's realist assumption. It's an interesting question to consider what underlying principle about the world we live in is such that these theories are excluded and we're limited to this now. So Einstein was wrong because implicitly his assumptions entail that we're limited to this bound, and we find that we're not. So one of his assumptions is wrong, but he has two assumptions, and the locality assumption could be well, seems to be straightforwardly associated with a no-signaling principle. So it would be better to refer to it as the no-signaling assumption. But this holds for all those theories. So at least part of Einstein's realism is preserved. What's not preserved is this principle of separability. Now, it seems to me that one could think of this principle in the following way. Insofar as nothing in Einstein's arguments for the incompleteness of quantum mechanics depend on determinism, I mean, as Pauli emphasizes, the arguments go through, as I've shown. The arguments, all the arguments that I've come up with go through if you simply assume that what Einstein had in mind by, what's the terminology that he sometimes uses, the being thus of the system over there, was some kind of stochastic being thus that satisfied in those signaling principles. If you take it that Einstein's notion of a being thus is that stochastic notion, then we can say that, well, Einstein had in mind a classical information source, which is, say, producing either zero, probability zero, or one, probability one, or of course, string of zeros. We just consider this work. So some source which is producing a zero or a one. Notice that, talking about classical versus quantum theories here, there's nothing about classical mechanics. I mean, there's no dynamics in any of this argument, any of these arguments. The notion of classicality, I mean, the notion that underlies this bound, it's simply the idea of a theory which is quote-unquote classical in the sense that it satisfies Einstein's realist assumptions. So all we're talking about are systems which produce probability distributions satisfying these constraints. And so we could think of a classical system, say, in this sense, as producing strings of zeros and ones with certain probabilities. So just to take the case of a zero and one, if you had a system like this, you could copy it in the following sense. You could take the output, which is 0 or 1 with these probabilities, and put it into a CNOT gate, a control NOT gate, which has two inputs. So this input take as 0, and this input is either 0 or 1. So it's 0 or 1. This is the output. Let's say the input I is equal to 0 or 1. And this input here is the output of this classical stochastic source. What's going to then come out here is this is called control bit of the CNOT gate. It's the target bit. This always comes out the same. So if 0 goes in, it comes out 0. But this bit is the same if this is 0 and it's flipped if this is 1. So clearly this is going to be I as well, because if this is 0, then this is 0, and the 0 stays the same. If this is 1, then the 0 is flipped to a 1. So you're going to get 0, 0, or 1, 1. So a CNOT gate copies, CNOT gate copies the output of a classical information source. Of course, the whole point of these lectures was to go through what a classical information source is and to go through some background on Shannon's theory and to talk about these principles. But I thought in the first lecture it would be better if I just sort of motivated some sort of general philosophical viewpoint about the whole thing and sort of suggested to you where I'm going and then took a look at it. So I do want to talk about what is a classical information source in Shannon's sense and so on and so forth. And I guess I'll do that next time.
So you say that you can copy any classical system using such a device in principle?
In principle, yeah. Because if you could take, suppose this thing was a string of zeros and ones, zeros.
That's how a system in classical mechanics has infinite numbers of zeros and ones in principle.
Well, yeah, but I'm thinking here of I mean, if you're thinking of a classical state, in terms of the precise specification of positions and momenta, well, then it's an infinite sequence of zeros and ones to specify a point in classical phase space. But if we simply consider sort of a finite version of that, then and we talk, let's say we talk about a classical system like Tuscan point, then the phase space is going to have 6 points in it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So it's a 6-point phase space, and a state of the coin would be specified in one or so. So you could think of the phase space as some set with 6 points in it, and subsets of these could be associated with properties like being even. So this would be, 2, 4, and 6. So this would be associated with that subset. And so the classical phase space with an infinite number of points is just an infinite generalization of that notion. But if we think of a classical information source as producing sequences of zeros and ones, 0, 1, 0, 0, blah, where there are, let's say, k zeros and ones, then we could simply take k CNOT gates, which operate on these in sequence, and the battery of CNOT gates would clone the sequences as they come out, and we could probably do the same. I use the word cloning here, but in a precise sense, this is not cloning. I mean, I'm cloning the outputs, but in terms of the whole information source, which is what I'm thinking of as Einstein being thus, I haven't cloned the probability distribution. To clone the probability distribution would be to have one probability distribution and then end up with two. But I don't have two probability distributions. Rather, instead of having a probability distribution with, well, in this particular case, probability zero, for zero, and a probability one for one, I've got a probability of 0, 0, 1, 1 with the same probabilities. And that's referred to as broadcasting, in the sense that when you broadcast, you've got the, it ends up that both, let's say, radio receivers, are vibrating in the same way. They're both showing 0, they're both showing 1, with the same probabilities. And so this notion really is a broadcasting. That is to say, the marginal states of A and of B are the same. So I've got a state of the composite system now, which is this and this with certain probabilities, but the marginal statistical states are both the same. That is, the state of this system is I with the probability I, and the state of the system is I with the probability I. But really, I've got II with certain probability.
Is that a non-trivial task to go from finite dimensions to infinite dimensional systems, or? Classical systems are.
Well, it's going to involve all the usual kinds of problems that infinities always introduce. Yeah. And in discussions of information theory, in discussions of quantum information, anyway, I'm thinking of sort of like the Bible, the Hilsen-Chuang book, they don't consider the infinite case. They're always considering finite quantum systems. And so, yes, the infinite case might introduce sort of mathematical complexities and possibly even conceptual issues which I haven't thought of, but I haven't thought of those. But that's a good question. Okay, so if you had any classical source like this, then you can copy it with a CNOT gate. But if you had quantum states coming in, if you had a source which produced quantum states, then it's not going to work. And it's not going to work, and I'm really now anticipating something that I want to show a little bit later, and that is the quantum no-cloning theorem. Because if you have a quantum CNOT gate, and these are quantum states coming in, and you set this state to zero quantum state, so this is set to zero, And this is either 0 or 1. Well, then I'm going to get 0 or 1 here. Let me say I equals 0 or 1. Then I'm going to get I here. And the quantum Cnot gate works the same way, that if I've got a 0 here, then this stays 0. And if I've got a 1 here, then flip. So this comes to the state I. But if instead of that, I have the input as a linear superposition of zero of the two orthogonal states 0 and 1, suppose alpha 0 plus beta 1 coming in, and this is 0, then seeing that this gate here, in this particular case, when I talk about the classical system, this was a Boolean gate acting on these bits. But this gate has to be, it has to be something that fits with the dynamics of quantum mechanics, which means it has to be a linear evolution. It has to be a unitary transformation. And so this thing is going to just take the product of these two states to wherever it takes 0, 0, plus wherever it takes 1, 0. So this means that what I'm going to get out here is alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1. Because the gate will act linearly. The gate will act linearly on this component and this component, and we know that that goes to 0, 0. Then we know that 1, 0 goes to 1, 1. And these are linearly superposed with alpha and beta, so I'm going to get that. So I don't get a comp. I get a tangent state. And this basically is the quantum no cloning theorem. I mean, is a more precise way of putting it, which I will go through later. But so you can clone classical states in this sense. So you can broadcast classical mixtures of probability distributions, but you can't in the case of quantum systems. And the possibility of cloning, yeah.
I don't understand. It's suppose you have these two things, right? In these two states. So you can send, say, the second bit to one observer and the first bit, the first state to the other observer, to some other observer. And then if they have their measuring device set up the same way, they're going to get the same signal. So
wait, I don't understand. So say that again. You have the input of a linear superposition.
Right. And then, so you out here, you get, say, two like photons or something, right? Because
you get
two photons.
Yeah, because these output, I mean, this is purely symbolic, and the output always has to be represented in the physical state.
Yes, so suppose it's photons.
Yeah, but I mean, I would have it in an entangled state.
Yeah, but then you can send one of the photons, say, to one observer.
Yeah.
And the other photon to another observer. And then they set up their radio, basically their measuring instrument, to measure the thing the same way. Then they're going to receive exactly the same signal.
So wait, you're saying that this guy goes, what I've got is an entangled state.
Yes, but you can have an entangled state that's a polarization, for example.
Yeah, now I'm going to send them into two different directions. I'm going to make a measurement on here and a measurement on here, and over here I would get, let's say a 0 and a 0.
Yeah.
But that's not cloning
the original state.
They don't have two photons in the same space. They have a two photon system which is not a copy.
No, but I mean, it serves the same process. You can still broadcast it, just like you broadcasted before.
I mean, you can't take an arbitrary alpha and beta and
have. No, because the point of broadcasting was if I measure, you send the first particle to the left, another one to the right. But then if you just get copies, then whatever the two guys do or observe, it will be the same. So, you don't have to put the rule. If the one measures whatever's pinned on the
board. Yeah, I mean, they have to have the same radius. Their measuring instrument has to be the same.
But I think the simple, simple answer is that what you're trying to copy is the state. So what you want to end up with is two copies of the state. You want to end up with alpha zero. I mean, what would be a copy? What would be a copying is this. If I had some device, I went in alpha 0 plus beta 1, this is 0, and then I had alpha 1 plus beta 0, and alpha 1 plus beta 0. This would be a copy. But now if you get as a first stage alpha 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, and then you put in your devices, you know, you sent them separately, and you made a measurement. In effect, you'd be putting this into some other box, but what would come out would be something like 0, 0, you know, 4, 1, 1. But you wouldn't come out with two copies of the initial state.
No, when you think of it operational,
yeah,
the quantum thing and the classical thing do exactly the same thing. In the quantum thing, you're not, as you said, you're not copying the source. You're just making it either into, you're copying the signal. And in the classical case,
let's refer to outcomes. I mean, 0 or 1. So I'm copying the outcome.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm getting 0, 0, or 1.
And
1.
If you send the two photons in different things, you are copying the outcome. The outcome will be the same for the two observers.
No. Yeah. Outcome means state, not measurement result.
Yeah, outcome means whatever comes out.
It means nothing to the state, right? Because you can't measure it. If you have the same instruments on both sides, the outcome will be the measured result will be the same.
Well,
you can operationally do the same thing, which is a broadcast. You send the same, the people will measure the same thing at two different ends. Operationally, it's still going to be a broadcast. It's going to be exactly the same thing.
You then
I don't understand the point.
Wait a minute. You can. Let me just think. You. Well, what the outcome? What the output of? What the output of the source is a quantum state. I'm saying if the output of the source is a quantum state, then you input the quantum state into your supposed copier. It's supposed to produce two copies of whatever came in, and it did produce two copies of whatever came in. What it did was, what you're saying is, you're saying you can, once you measure this, then you're producing two orthogonal states, 0 or 1, and you suddenly can copy those. So, we'll broadcast those. So, once you introduce this measuring device, then what you've done is you've taken this thing that I'm calling the output of my information source, and you're measuring it, and then you're cloning the measurement outcome. But I'm not producing two of these guys. So that's what the things that you produce at the end of your process of measurement, that is two zeros or two ones with the probabilities alpha and beta, alpha squared, beta alpha, mod squared, beta mod squared, are not two copies of this original state, and they won't have the same properties as this original state. If I really had two copies of this, then I would be able to, I have something else.
Sure, but as you said, I mean, the first thing is also you're not getting two copies of the source. You're just getting.
I'm getting two copies of whatever the source produces. You know, and in this particular case, you could have a source which is producing quantum states. Effectively, these strings of zeros and ones are all analogous to orthogonal quantum states. And as long as you have orthogonal quantum states, because we saw here, if you have 0 or 1, then you can copy. Then if you had any set of zeros and ones, you can always, if you had more, like n orthogonal states could copy the C-naught gate. But if you have states which are intersected sort of at a non-orthogonal angle to other states, talking quite mechanically, like this state, it's not orthogonal to zero, then that screws things up, because the linear evolution of the gate will not be able to make two copies. It will produce an entangled state. And you can make measurements on the entangled state, but you don't produce two copies of the original thing, if that's the claim. So now, I just want to sort of wind up with some comments about it. Yeah?
Yeah, just in other words, what you're thinking about is classical. You're saying, let me broadcast measurement results. And these are classical things. These are just zeros and ones. And there is no problem broadcasting those with quantum information or with classical information.
You're not broadcasting the measurement results.
Yeah, yeah, because when you're saying, you know, the two guys, when they measure these photons, they will get zeros or ones. That's what your broadcast.
But I mean, they can both be measuring in the x-axis and it will be the same thing. The thing is that what they actually see will be the same.
Yeah, but that's broadcasting measurement results. That's not broadcasting the quantum.
The results are only taken at the receiver end. You're not broadcasting. I mean, you're not doing a measurement there and then broadcasting the results. You're broadcasting some states.
Yeah, but the point is, if you just have the two particles.
Maybe we should talk about this later.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, let me just make a couple of sort of points to sort of wind up and set things up for next time. If you can clone, then you can distinguish the states. Because even in the case of, now I'm talking in terms of quantum mechanics, if you could copy these states and make as many copies as you want, then even though quantum mechanically, you can't distinguish between two states, alpha and beta, which are non-orthogonal. You can't identify an arbitrary quantum state. You can't distinguish two such states. And again, you'll sort of see this sort of more precisely when I talk about the POVMs and so on. But if you could clone this, and you could clone it as many times as you want, and so get a tensor product, alpha cross alpha cross alpha cross alpha, these states tend to orthogonality as n becomes larger and larger. So in principle, if you can clone, then you can distinguish. And if you can distinguish, then you can clone, because if I could distinguish two states, alpha and beta, and identify them, by distinguish, I mean I could tell which of two states it is, then if I know what the state is and I assume that I could prepare any of those states, well, then I can clone. So if I can distinguish the state from this state, I can make two copies. Some other sort of interesting features of this, that classically, when you have a probability distribution of the sort that presumably Einstein was thinking about, classical information source that produces 0 or 1, you have certain probabilities. This is a fixed probability distribution over 0 and 1, or over strings of zeros and ones. That is to say, there is a unique decomposition of the representation of the probability distribution as a particular probability distribution. 50% 0, 50% 1, or 25% 0, 75% 1. And if there is such a unique decomposition of a mixture of probability distribution, then you can broadcast, or you can clone the outcomes and hence broadcast the distribution. But if there is not, then you're into a case like quantum mechanics where you can't. So if you can, then you can clone, and if you can't, then you can't clone or broadcast, so to speak more generally. Mm-hmm. If you could clone, you would also be able to take states like this, 0, 0, plus 1, 1, and be able to use them for signaling. you have two systems which are in this entangled state over here. You can't use it for signaling because the probabilities over here are determined by the so-called reduced state by tracing over this Hilbert space over here. You could signal with this entangled state if you could clock in the following way. It makes no difference to, let's say, but Alice and Bob here. And Alice wants to signal to Bob. Well, she might measure in the x direction. So I suppose these are spin up and down in the x direction, in which case she's either going to get the state 0, 0, or 1, 1 with 50% probability. But that doesn't change anything in terms of the statistics that Bob signed. It's still 50% 0, 50% 1. But it's to say this mixture and this pure state have the same reduced state over here. Similarly, if Alice measured in some other direction, the reduced state would be the same here. But if Bob could clone the states over here, then seeing that Alice, by making a particular measurement, in effect picks out a particular mixture over here, either a mixture of 50%, let's say I'm using a different notation, let's say Z up and 50% Z down, or 50% X up and 50% X down. I mean, by making a Z measurement, Z split measurement, or X split measurement on the system in her over here, she can create a particular distribution on the other side. The only thing is that Bob can't tell the difference because the statistics of these distributions are identical. But if Alice, so to speak, has created this distribution on this side as opposed to this distribution, Bob could detect that if he could clone, because he would make n copies of this thing, and then he would have this state as opposed to these states, and he can distinguish these. He can distinguish, whether he's got a Z up tensor product n times from an X up or an X down state. You can't distinguish this mixture, 50% Z up, 50% down, Z down from 50% X up, 50% X down. But you can distinguish the mixture, 50% Z, 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 Z up, 50% Z, 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 Z down from this other mixture of the X's. So if you could clone, then you could signal superimposition. So these notions of cloning and identifying and signaling and so on are all interrelated in depending on the particular theory that you're talking about. So that's something that I want to consider. Now, I wanted to wind up, but I think I'll just sort of mention this and pick up from here next time. Go back to Bell. I mean, Bell successfully presented a counter argument against Einstein, but he's also famous for another paper called Against Measurement. And in this paper, he sort of takes an Einsteinian point of view. That is, he suggests that quantum mechanics, which involves, in some sense, taking measurement as fundamental, is just not cannot be taken as a fundamental theory. And he opts for either a hidden variable theory of Bohm's sort or a collapse theory of the GRW sort. So in some sense, he's reneging on the arguments that he produced against Einstein. Not that he now accepts, not that he rejects these conclusions over here, but rather that he wants to draw different conclusions from the fact that this classical bound is violated. So, maybe I should actually just read a quick quote. He says, Here are some words which, however legitimate and necessary in application, have no place in a formulation with any pretension to physical precision, formulation of physical theory. System, apparatus, environment, microscopic, macroscopic, reversible, irreversible, observable, information, measurement. The concept system, apparatus, environment immediately imply an artificial division of the world and an intention to neglect or take only schematic account of the interaction across the split between macro and micro, perhaps system and apparatus. The notions of microscopic and macroscopic defy precise definition, so also do the notions of reversible and irreversible. Einstein said that it is theory which decides what is observed. Well, I think he was right. Observation is a complicated and theory-laden business. Then that notion should not appear in the formulation of fundamental theory. Information? Whose information? Information about what? On this list of bad words from good books, the worst of all is measurement. So, you know, in the formulation of fundamental theory, there shouldn't be any formulation to measurement. Now, I just want to wind up with another quote from an article on quantum information by Werner. He says, and this is, I think it's just a relative skip, whose information, what information. Information theory does not care whether a TV channel is used for misinformation. It can say everything about what it takes to ensure the technical quality of the final images. Hence, the quantitative measures of information, quote unquote, all relate to storage and transmission capacity, to the possibilities of compression and error correction, and so on. In the same vein, quantum information theory will not tell us what the meaning of a quantum message is, and this is probably meaningless anyway, because the message that has been read is classical almost by definition. The quantum information theory has precise notions of the resources needed to transmit such information faithfully. So this business of like whose information, what information, these comments about measurement, I think are largely polemical, partly because when you're talking about information theory and the difference between classical information and quantum information, you're really interested in questions like resources and the compression of information and the ability of physical systems to transmit information. I mean, what the information stands for is really up to you. I mean, a bit 0-1 might stand for start a war, or don't start a war, or it might just be birthday greetings or something like that, say hi. So now I'm ending up, unfortunately. I've got 2 minutes left, so let me wind up and say where all this is going, what I want to do next time. Where I'm going with all this is as follows. It seems to me that once you realize that underlying Einstein's, maybe I haven't sort of really shown this, but I hope it's sort of been suggested, underlying Einstein's notion of the being thus of the system, which is the underlying Einstein's notion of separability, which is part of his notion of realism, is some notion of the copyability, of the possibility that being thuses can be copied in a certain sense. And I include here sort of broadcasting as copying. And it's that which doesn't hold for quantum mechanics. So the essential thing about quantum information that makes it different from classical information, and then also the essential thing about these other theories which are not quantum, is that you've got a no cloning or no broadcasting theorem, which is going to apply to those theorems. So what is characteristic of quantum systems is essentially copyability. So if that's what's going on here, really, in Einstein's notion of realism, if somehow or other he sort of smuggled in some notion of the possibility of copying here, but that this other aspect of his notion of realism is, you can have quantum mechanics associated and still have a notion of separate systems characterized by this condition over here. We still have a no signaling principle. Then it seems that what is characteristic of quantum mechanics is that the systems that you're talking about can't be copied, which means that, in effect, that they can't be measured. because where I'm using measurement now is almost synonymous with copy. I mean, if you had the classical systems, which take a C naught gate, which you can take as sort of a classical copier, you could consider this essentially the possibility of copying and associated with the possibility of measuring. I mean, if what comes out here is high, but it could also come out. You could also have some modification of the state where some I prime or I prime comes out. But this is the measurement output, and this is the changed input state, provided that this change was something that you could calculate and account for dynamically. If that was the case, then you could put the thing into some other kind of gate and get back the, you know, the I and the from the I prime and the R I prime. So the possibility of copying and the possibility of measuring in the sense of making an accurate copy or having some information from which you could, in principle, make an accurate copy are very closely tied together. So if you have no cloning characteristic of quantum systems, then the whole notion of measurement has to be understood differently. It's not that you're doing something which is remotely like copying the beingness or something out of it, or even broadcasting the beingness. You're doing something else when you're making a measurement. It's not that there is something there, as in the classical case, the sequence of zeros and ones, which you are just distinguishing from other sequences of zeros and ones or copying. It's rather that the output, when you make a measurement on it, of a quantum information source, you're doing something else. We have to consider what that is. But all that suggests, at least it doesn't prove anything, but I mean, I want to claim this, sort of suggested the fact that maybe the way to think about quantum systems is information theoretically, in terms of the concepts of information. Well, what we do when we make a measurement system is to extract information in a sense which you can handle in terms of information theory, and but where it's not synonymous with the fact that you've extracted some information from the system does not entail that you can copy the system. So this suggests that we should look at the difference between classical and quantum mechanics in terms of information theory, and that then is the motivation for looking at it in terms of rethinking the foundations of quantum mechanics. Like I said, last bit was like a little bit rapid. So let me just say what I want to do next time. This was somewhat informal and hand-waving and suggested, and that's all it was meant to be. But the remaining lectures, what I want to do is to sort of go through. Well, I thought I'd get through some of this today, but I didn't. Part of what I wanted to do was just to go through some sort of standard stuff on classical and quantum information theory, which I got from various places, mostly from the Nielsen Chuang group. And then I wanted to do some stuff on quantum cryptography and quantum computation and so on, which is my own contribution. So I don't know how much of the standard stuff people know. So what I'll do next time is just go through it, and you can give me feedback as I go through it, whether it's totally obvious or whether we need to go through it. But I'll start with that review of classical quantum, basic concepts of classical quantum information. I have a sort of strong feeling that people know a lot of that already. And then the, okay. But he won't be here. He's leaving for Paris tomorrow, like you got. Okay, so then I'll do that next time. And but I mean, I think the interesting things that I have to say have to do with quantum cryptography, quantum computation, and the significance of all this for the foundational issues. Okay.
Ask the last question.
Oh, sure.
Just referring to the quote you just read out.
Uh-huh.
So I do not really understand, like, well, when you say that quantum information basically treats information, but it does not really care basically about what the information is about. And so there are issues like you make measurements, but you have to divide the world into quantum world and a classical world to really be able to perform, to really know what measurement means. So I do not really understand how one can expect to get insights in the fundamental nature of the physical world from the quantum informational point of view when one does not really think about those things.
I'm not sure it's the connection with
with the measurement, basically, you talk about measurements all the time, but as far as I understand, like, if you use the word measurement in this context, you basically have to say that you divide the world into a classical part and into a part which follows the rules of quantum physics, because when you are able to do a measurement, then you basically have to couple your quantum system to a classical system.
Well, that would be,
system is okay. Described by quantum.
Right, I see what you're saying.
So I do not really understand like how one will be able to understand this connection, like basically the distinction into classical.
Yeah, if you take that view, which I think is Bohr's view as commonly understood, then that does make it difficult to see what's going on. I mean, if you say that, well, a measurement involves taking a classical system, interacting with a quantum system, and so on and so forth, as you said. So obviously, I'm hoping for something different. I think this is the way I see it. If you take no cloning as fundamentally characteristic of non-classical theories, not quantum mechanics per se, but anything which violates this bound and is also going to be within the classical theories where you have a no signal. I mean, we want to have a no signaling because we don't believe that we can signal, and we are in a world in which no signaling holds, and that seems to be, and at least that part of Einstein's realism, I think one has to hold on to. But this no cloning is going to distinguish theories which satisfy this bound from a broader class of theories. Okay, so once you've got, and just to sort of add one point, I mean, an interesting foundational theoretical question is, what other principles besides no cloning distinguish this class of theories from this broader class of theories? Okay, so now on this question that you raised, once you accept no cloning as a fundamental principle which characterizes this class of theories, then I think you have to realize that you will no longer have the possibility of a dynamical account of measurement all the way through, so to speak. I mean, you will, of course, have a dynamical account of measurement in the sense that you can always have one system called a measuring instrument, another system called a system, and describe a quantum mechanical interaction between the two of them. But in the last analysis, there's always going to be some system. I mean, I think this is going to follow from the cloning. There will always have to be some system which you take as your ultimate measuring instrument in the analysis, which is not further analyzed in terms of a dynamical account. Because if you could do that, then you would be able to, in effect, use that. Dynamics to characterize a copy. So there's always going to be some ultimate system which you're going to simply have to leave out of the analysis and treat as the ultimate measuring instrument. I mean, in practical terms, you can always look at that system, whatever it is, and analyze it further in terms of quantum mechanical interactions. I mean, if it's some particular device on the table. But then there's always going to be some aspect of that analysis again which is sort of left out. And that means that final system, which in your particular analysis you're not giving a dynamical account of, has to be understood as simply a classical information source. So, you know, there's going to ultimately be some classical information source, which in the sense that it's simply producing a probability distribution over classical probabilities or orthogonal states. And So the question is, so you're going to have that in this analysis, which means that you ultimately have the question of accounting for the possibility of such a source in this whole analysis. And I think that is the remains of the measurement problem in this particular account. Now, that's not actually the same as the usual formulation of the measurement problem, because the usual formulation of the measurement problem has to do with how you get a particular outcome as being, when you have, say, a Kangle state, how you get some particular outcome, because the usual formulation of the measurement problem is simply another way of looking at kind of plotting. I mean, you really say, look, the simplest way to put it is this. If I have a system which is in state alpha, and my measuring instrument is in state zero, and then I want it to go to alpha, alpha, or maybe alpha, alpha pi. So this is the point of reading, which is related to that. And if I have beta, and I'm zero, then I want it to go to beta, let's say beta prime. But then if I have a linear superposition, I'm going to go into an entangled state. And so the claim is, but look, I don't want the entangled state because that doesn't describe a particular pointer reading. I want to end up with a particular pointer reading, which means I don't want to end up, I start out with, let's say, let's say C1 alpha plus C2 beta zero. Then I'm going to end up with C1 alpha, let's say alpha prime, plus C2 beta, beta prime. And that's the same argument as a node cloning. So you say, I don't want this. I want to rather go to either, alpha, alpha prime, and point points to alpha, or in the beta, beta prime. And that's a simpler way of formulating it. And so the measurement problem is then the problem, well, how do I get that, all of that? If you had a collapse, then you would get this or this, or the other stories in terms of Bohm's theories or other theories. But this other problem that I've raised is simply, it's not how you get a particular outcome to be, so to speak, determinant, be real, if you like. It's rather, how do you get something which will produce a classical probability distribution, which is a slightly different problem. Now, but it still seems to me to be something that has to be explained. And I think that the story of how you get that can be given an analysis in terms of the notion of decoherence. I don't think decoherence will tell you how you get a particular outcome, or will justify a particular outcome. But I think that it might. Be able to show how you get a classical probability distribution from a quantum probability distribution. So I think the problem really is, if you look at it this way, then the problem, the measurement problem becomes changed from the problem of explaining how you get a particular outcome to the problem of how you get classical probability distributions. And decoherence is, I think, it suggests the possibility of a quantum mechanical explanation. So there wouldn't be an underlying assumption of two different classes of theories, classical theories and quantum theories. And if you take that point of view, then it seems to me you're not taking a fundamental approach to physics. But if you're saying that, look, what quantum theory is a new theory of information, the motivation for taking that step is essentially the known cloning. And once you recognize theories which violate this Searles and Bound as or the classical bound, not Searles and Bound, as known cloning theories, then these are theories for which you have to think about measurement in a different way. And that I take as
analogous to the situation with relativity theory. I mean, what was the fundamental new thing that led to relativity? Well, it was the discovery that the velocity of light is independent of the velocity of the source. This makes no sense in terms of Galilean relativity, and hence makes no sense in terms of the way we think about space and time and motion. So if you accept that, well, this happens to be true, you know, that about velocity of light, then this requires you, as I've said, Sewell, to rethink what you mean by simultaneity. And you then get a notion of simultaneity which is relative and not absolute, and so you have you've changed your concepts of space and time. Similarly, I think that the analogous discovery in the case of quantum mechanics to the light postulate is the no-cloning principle. Now you might say, well, but this is sort of very anachronistic because, you know, Einstein started with this light principle, which was lying around, so to speak, and people were puzzled by it, and then he proposed a solution to the problem. It wasn't that people recognized no cloning and then started proposing solutions to the problem. But underlying the whole debate between Einstein and Bohr is about the foundations of quantum mechanics, are these notions of measurement and how to understand quantum measurements and disturbance by measurements and all this kind of stuff. And if you think about it, what that has to do with is really no cloning. So it wasn't the fact that this was the way in which the puzzle was recognized, but really it's the same puzzle. What I want to say is that the essential thing about the puzzle that was at the bottom of the debate about what's going on with quantum mechanics, you know, has to do with this no cloning. And the claim is now that properly understood, just as understood, the light postulate leads to, you know, who would have thought that the light postulate leads to changing our notion of space and time? I mean, Lorentz didn't think that. Einstein came, well, you know, Poincaré, Einstein came up with that. So this requires sort of a radical shift. Well, similarly here, there is some radical shift required. The idea is that the radical claim here, if I want to kind of present, is that the claim has to do with the recognition of the significance of no cloning. And the recognition of the significance of no cloning is that the appropriate way to understand quantum mechanics is in terms of information theory concepts. So that really is the idea here. Yeah.
So I think I can only fully appreciate the significance of no cloning of quantum information if I see that the quantum information itself comes from how it is determined, say, operation B. Otherwise, it's just some algebraic statements containing symbols. So those can evaluate, but to physically understand, I think I would like to see how is the quantum information itself determined?
How is it defined?
Yes, not defined. How is it determined from the real physical system? Something which we are exposed to in our laboratory, and then what we investigate with certain measurement devices and so on.
Well, the short answer to that is that one can think of a classical information source as a source which is just producing certain outputs which can be cloned or copied. With certain probabilities. And a quantum information source is then going to be a source that produces outputs which could be quantum states, just outputs which can't necessarily be copied. So the outputs of a quantum information source would be quantum states. And so from a physical point of view, what you're talking about really, when you talk about a quantum system, is when you talk about quantum information, you're really just talking about information sources that produce quantum states. So whatever physical systems, from a physical point of view, whatever physical systems in the laboratory you have which produces quantum states is understood as a quantum information source. I'm not sure if I've understood the
question. So we distinguish the physical system and the information of the physical system. And I always thought it's the physicist who is producing the information of the system itself.
Well, it's a shift in Well, the two points of views that you can take here. One, you've got sort of quantum physics, which is about quantum systems, and, you know, it's the stuff in a quantum the textbook on quantum mechanics, and you know the experimental side has to do with the experimental side. And then you can take quantum information as simply a an extension of classical information theory to such quantum systems. And that's perfectly clear. You know, you the sort of fundamental thing are sort of your quantum systems, and this quantum information theory is just the theory about how you can use quantum systems to communicate or perform certain information theoretic tasks. How you can use quantum states to store information, and how you can use quantum interactions as channels for communication of information. That you can take another standpoint, which is the standpoint that I'm proposing here, and that is to take the quantum theory itself as fundamentally a theory of quantum information, and say that the way we understand that the revolution from classical to quantum theory is that the way to understand the physical world is through the concept of information. That this wasn't required in the case of classical physics, essentially because the information that's produced using classical systems is copyable. But once you have a no cloning principle, then, and this is the thesis that I want to propose, so it's not something which is just general accepted. And the thesis I want to propose is that once you have no cloning principle, then the way to grasp the nature of the physical systems involved is essentially through the notion of information. And so this is the consequence of no cloning. So for theories which satisfy this bound, you can take Einstein's point of view and so on. For theories which violate this bound, we have to adopt a different, something has to be changed. So in the same way that with relativity theory we had to change the way we think about space and time, here we have to change the way we think about physical systems themselves in a fundamental sense, and talk about them through the concepts of information. So that's sort of what I hope to try and catch out through these two.